And we know that all things work together for good to those who love God, to those who are called according to His purpose. According to Romans 8, verse 28. What Paul said there is true, as demonstrated in the story of Esther. Although the players in the story are unaware of what God was doing, except for perhaps Mordecai. But my question is, when we refer to Romans 8:28, and we talk about God working all things together for good, what is the good that God is working all things together toward? Esther may have thought at first that it was giving her everything she wanted. That it was making her queen, enjoying her beauty, having a comfortable life. However, remember that in the first four chapters, we saw what God wanted to see in her life. And in particular, I try to draw your attention to Esther 4, verse 16. Do you remember what was said there? Esther told Mordecai, after she had learned of the plot to exterminate the Jews in the Persian Empire, and Mordecai put her on the spot that she was the one who could do something about it and stop it, she then requested that Mordecai fast along with her, her handmaidens, and the rest of the Jews. And here's what is said in Esther 4:16. Go gather all the Jews who are present in Shushan and fast for me. Neither eat nor drink for 3 days, night or day. My maids and I will likewise fast. And so I will go to the king, which is against the law. And if I perish, I perish. The good of Romans 8:28 is not a gushy life, but it is surrendering to the will of God, allowing ourselves to be made into the image of Jesus Christ. And is that not what He did? Today, the world is celebrating the resurrection of Christ. And how did He ever get to that point? It's because He surrendered Himself to the Father that we might eventually have the good that He brought into the world and into our lives by means of His death, burial, and resurrection. And the reason I know all this, that Romans 8:28, that the good intended there is that we might be like Jesus who surrendered Himself, is because of what the next verse says in Romans 8. It's always good to see what the rest of the context has to say. And notice how verse 29 begins with the word for. That tells you that Paul's about ready to give you an explanation for what he just said. For whom he foreknew, that's us. God foreknew us. He also predestined us, here it is, to be conformed to the image of his Son, that he might be the firstborn among many brethren. So what is God working to do? He's working to conform me to the image of His Son. It can't simply be so that everything always turns out in life the way I want it to, because everything in life doesn't always turn out the way I want it to, does it? And it doesn't happen that way in the Bible either. People's lives were frequently turned around and turned upside down, and that is certainly what is happening in the book of Esther. Sometimes it seems that there's no way out of a devastating situation. But it might be that God is using that situation to conform us to the image of His Son, Jesus. Therefore, let us learn to see matters from not from our perspective and what we want, but from God's perspective and what He wants out of us. Mordecai and the Jews were faced with a horrible prospect in the book of Esther. But did God allow it that they might see His work? Mordecai, we learned a couple of weeks ago, did good for the king, but it seems as though it had been forgotten. Is it possible that God waited to reward Mordecai so that He could use the reward for something good later? Haman's, the antagonist in this story here, Haman's preoccupation with self led him into deep trouble. He was not working towards God's goals, but he was in love with himself rather than with God. But for those who love God, all things work together for good because they want to be more like Christ and less like self. Haman's preoccupation, self-preoccupation, led to the mistreatment of another person because he was hurt and offended when someone else, Mordecai, didn't think as highly of Haman as Haman thought of himself. Do you remember how we ended last Sunday morning with Esther chapter 5? I want to read the last three verses again. Esther 5, verses 12 to 14. Moreover, Haman said, besides, he's saying this to his family and his friends, after stating how he's been humiliated by Mordecai and how he's so angry at him, he says, moreover, besides, Queen Esther invited no one but me to come with the king to the banquet that she prepared. And tomorrow I am again invited by her along with the king. Yet all this avails me nothing, so long as I see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gate. Then his wife Zeresh and all his friends said to him, let a gallows be made, 50 cubits high, that is 75 feet high. And in the morning suggest to the king that Mordecai be hanged on it. Then go merrily with the king to the banquet. And the thing pleased Haman, so he had the gallows made. Now watch God's perfect timing of events. Interestingly, in Esther chapter 6, the two heroes of the story are not found here. Esther is not even mentioned by name. Mordecai is mentioned, but he's not manipulating things. He's not manipulating the king. He's not condemning Haman. These two have been taken out, in a sense. And now God is orchestrating things, as He often does, for the favor of His people. So now watch verses 1 through 3. Is it ever good not to sleep at night? Let's find out. That night, the king could not sleep. So one was commanded to bring the book of the records of the Chronicles, and they were read before the king. And it was found written that Mordecai had told of Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs, the doorkeepers who had sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. Then the king said, what honor or dignity has been bestowed on Mordecai for this? And the king's servants who attended him said, nothing has been done for him. Did you notice the way verse 1 started? That night. Well, what night? The night that was referred to in the 5th chapter. The same night in which Haman and his wife and his friends are plotting to kill Mordecai. That same night, King Ahasuerus can't sleep. And he's trying to figure out, how can I honor Mordecai? What can I do? Now, was it God's providence that the king had the Chronicles read to him? Was it God's providence that the king could not sleep? We don't know. The Bible doesn't come right out and say. Whether or not God makes things happen here or simply uses them to His advantage, again, there's really no indication. But it's interesting that the king did make good use of his time. Perhaps he was hoping that by reading or having read to him some boring government documents, if you've ever read any, you know what I'm talking about, he would go back to sleep. But interestingly, everyone else is sleeping but the king. And as a result of this, the king rediscovers Mordecai, a man whom the king had forgotten. And now the king can't think of anybody else but Mordecai. Do you remember back in chapter 2? That as we're going through the story, all of a sudden the writer interjected something about what Mordecai had done. And we wondered, what does this have to do with the story? Let's turn back to it. Go back to chapter 2, and I'll start reading verse 21. After stating how Esther was made queen of the Persian Empire in place of Vashti, whom the king got rid of, it then says this all of a sudden. In those days, while Mordecai sat within the king's gate, two of the king's eunuchs, Bigthan and Teresh, doorkeepers, became furious and sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. So the matter became known to Mordecai, who told Queen Esther. And Esther informed the king in Mordecai's name. And when an inquiry was made into the matter, it was confirmed and both were hanged on a gallows. And it was written in the book of the Chronicles in the presence of the king. And that's it. Chapter 3, the rest of the story doesn't say anything about it. All of a sudden, we come to chapter 6. And here it comes again. But I want you to notice this. If you're still in chapter 2, look at verse 16. And you will notice that this assassination attempt happened in the fifth year of the king's reign. Then you move over into chapter 3, verse 7, and all of a sudden it's the 12th year of the king's reign. And that's when this plot to kill the Jews was formed by Haman. 5 years go by between the assassination attempt and Mordecai's exposure of it, and then this reading of the chronicles of the Persian government here in chapter 6. 5 years pass from the time that Mordecai does his good deed and when he's going to end up being blessed for it. Now, another man at the same time is also focused on Mordecai, but with much different thoughts. The will of Haman and the will of Mordecai have been clashing, but not like Haman's and the king's are about to clash. There's a verse in Proverbs 19 that I think pictures so well King Ahasuerus, and in fact may picture a lot of world leaders. Haman experienced the good side of the king that's referred to in this verse, but by abusing that good side, he's now about to experience the severe side of a king dictator. In Proverbs 19:12 it says, "The king's wrath is like the roaring of a lion, but his favor is like dew on the grass." Now Mordecai is an honorable man. So when it seemed that he was going to experience the roaring of the king of Persia, that is, he and all his Jews would be exterminated, things turn around and now he's about to receive the due of the king. And Scripture assures us that God does not overlook good. It might seem like he has, and it might be a while before he does something about it, but he's got his reasons for what appears to us to be a delay. In Matthew 10, Jesus promised that if we do something so small as give a glass of cold water to someone whom we think is insignificant, we won't lose our reward. He said in Matthew 10 and verse 42, "And whoever gives one of these little ones only a cup of cold water in the name of a disciple, assuredly I say to you, he shall by no means lose his reward." And again, in the book of Hebrews, Hebrews 6, the Bible even suggests that God would be wrong. And may the thought ever perish if we could ever think that God would be wrong. But if he were to forget some kind of good that we did, it would be wrong on God's part. So Hebrews 6:10 says, "For God is not unjust to forget your work and labor of love which you have shown toward his name, in that you have ministered to the saints and do minister." So the good that you did for someone 10 years ago, that maybe you've even forgotten, God hasn't forgotten it. Mordecai may have forgotten what he did for the king, who knows? But God somehow remembered and is bringing all these things together to bless the man for. Well, let's get back into our story. Esther chapter 6, verses 4 and 5 now says this. "And the king said, who is in the court? Now Haman had just entered the outer court of the king's palace to suggest that the king hang Mordecai on the gallows that he had prepared for him. The king's servants said to him, Haman is there standing in the court. And the king said, let him come in." Now look at the timing. Now maybe Haman, or King Ahasuerus, is one of the kind of people that he gets excited about reading something like government documents. And so it didn't put him to sleep. It woke him up. I've seen people do that. Have you seen people do that with technical stuff? And you can look at it and you read one sentence, you haven't got the slightest idea what it says, and your eyelids are already starting to come down. And there's others that read it, and it's like they can't get enough. Give me some more coffee. And they get fired up. And he must have been a man like that, because this lasted through the night. It's now the next morning, and Haman's on his way to see the king. Look at the timing here. Now, do you see Esther or Mordecai in the picture manipulating the king or condemning Haman? Not at all. Yet, there were things the cousins had to do. We've already seen that. But then from there, the providence of God takes over and carries out the plan. Look at the timing again. Haman is eager to ask the king something. But the king just happens to ask first. The two come together and the king says, "I got a question that I'd like to ask you," as we'll see. Now, I often wondered, what if Haman had asked first? In his excitement, he got that to the king and he asked his question. Well, you know, the king would have said, "Look, I was planning on honoring this man. I think you now deserve to die." But God did not allow those circumstances to happen, because there's something else that has to happen in the story first. There's still another element that has to happen, which we'll see in future Sundays. Something else has to happen, so God causes all these things to happen according to his own timing. Now let's continue and watch what happens when a man thinks only of himself. Verse 6 of Esther chapter 6. "So Haman came in, and the king asked him, what shall be done for the man whom the king delights to honor? Now Haman thought in his heart, whom would the king delight to honor more than me?" I mean, this is almost laughable if it were not so serious. Well, it was true that the king did like to honor Haman. I mean, after all, he exalted him to the number two position in the empire. But it was not true that Haman was the only man that the king wanted to honor. There were others. Evidently, he let his success and let himself go to his own head. But Haman saw this as a time where he could really shine. "He who craves honor will not be satisfied with the honor he already has." Haman was made advisor to the king to answer questions just like this. And it was a wide open question. He knew the king's capability for, remember, at the banquet that Esther has already had with the king, Haman was there also, and he saw how the king said to his queen, "Hey, what do you want, Esther? I'll give you half of the kingdom." And all this stuff must have been going through this man's mind. So how is a self-centered, power-hungry man going to answer a question like that? And it may be very well that the king knew how Haman thought. He knew that if I ask Haman this question, I know what he's going to say. He's going to be thinking about himself. So I know what a great honor he'll give himself. And that's what I want. I want a really grand honor for this man that I want to honor this day. So Haman thinks of himself, not thinking of pleasing the king, because his world revolved around himself. Again, the story continues now in verses 7 through 9. And Haman answered the king, "For the man whom the king delights to honor, let a royal robe be brought which the king has worn, and a horse on which the king has ridden, which has a royal crest placed on its head. Then let this robe and horse be delivered to the hand of one of the king's most noble princes, that he may array the man whom the king delights to honor. Then parade him on horseback through the city square, and proclaim before him, 'Thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor.'" I really do wonder if Haman started to think, for the man that you want to honor, here's what you ought to do. And he wants the man who receives this honor to appear as the king himself. In other words, Haman reverses the golden rule. The golden rule says, I will use myself as a standard for how I want to treat you. But instead, he reverses that and says, I want to figure out how you can honor me. I want to use you as a standard for how you should honor me. And then he receives the shock of a lifetime in verses 10 and 11. Then the king said to Haman, "Hasten, take the robe and the horse, as you suggested, and do so for Mordecai the Jew, who sits within the king's gate. Leave nothing undone of all that you have spoken." So Haman took the robe and the horse, arrayed Mordecai, and led him on horseback through the city square, and proclaimed before him, "Thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor." In a flash, the thrill of victory was snatched from Haman's heart and was replaced with the agony of defeat. 1,000 swords must have pierced through that man's heart when he heard the words, "Mordecai the Jew." What if the king had said at this point, "By the way, Haman, what was it that you were coming to see me about so early in the morning?" Mordecai had dishonored Haman in public, and now Haman must honor Mordecai in public. What if the king had rewarded Mordecai 5 years earlier? Then this whole chain of events would not be unfolding. Mordecai could not help his people now, as we'll see as we go further through the book of Esther. And amazingly, Haman did as the king commanded. I think that's truly amazing that he either didn't disobey, he didn't run away, he didn't take his life or something. And was Mordecai shocked by all this? How did he react? Perhaps he could see that what he had told Esther back in Esther 4:14, "Perhaps you have come to the kingdom for such time as this, or that if you don't deliver the Jews, Esther, help and deliverance will come from another people." He knew it was coming. So maybe he's just thinking to his mind, "Well, I didn't know how it was going to happen, but I guess this is it." Again, if I can take you to the book of Proverbs. Proverbs 27, this time, warns us about doing what Haman did, and by implication, teaches us to do what Mordecai did. Proverbs 27, verse 2. "Let another man praise you, and not your own mouth. A stranger, and not your own lips." Also in the 24th chapter of Proverbs, I think there's something here that Mordecai believed in and was practicing. Because you'll notice that the Bible record here does not tell us that Mordecai gloated over this or said something like, "Haman, could you say that a little louder, please, as you honor me here in town?" Nothing of that sort. Listen to what Proverbs 24:17-20 says. "Do not rejoice when your enemy falls, and do not let your heart be glad when he stumbles, lest the Lord see it and it displease him, and he turn away his wrath from him. Do not fret because of evildoers, nor be envious of the wicked, for there will be no prospect for the evil man. The lamp of the wicked will be put out." Well, that's exactly what's happening in this chapter. And we'll see it happen even more tonight in Esther chapter 7. So there's nothing in this biblical record to show that Mordecai was saying anything. He just appears to be quiet. Compare that with famous athletes or celebrities. Well, look at verses 12 and 13. Back in Esther 6. The humiliation has just begun for Haman. Then the king said to Haman, Hasten, 12 and 13. Afterward, Mordecai went back to the king's gate. But Haman hastened to his house, mourning and with his head covered. When Haman told his wife Zeresh and all his friends everything that had happened to him, his wise men and his wife Zeresh said to him, "If Mordecai, before whom you have begun to fall, is of Jewish descent, you will not prevail against him, but will surely fall before him." Mordecai doesn't seem to have been changed by these things at all. He was the same man. He's neither better nor worse, but he just simply goes back to doing what he was doing before. He goes back to the king's gate. But Haman is changed. He's been affected by this greatly. His head's covered, and he goes away in great shame. As Jesus once said, "Woe to you who are full, for you shall hunger. Woe to you who laugh now, for you shall mourn and weep." Luke 6 and verse 25. And that's why the Bible also tells us, "Lament and mourn and weep. Let your laughter be turned to mourning and your joy to gloom." James 4, 9. In other words, if we're having enjoyment in sin, then we need to change right now. We need to be filled with sorrow and repentance. Unlike Haman in this case. Now obviously, Haman and his wife and friends knew of Jewish history. And what does the history of God's people then and of Christians now tell us? God's people cannot be defeated. And if it appears that they've been defeated, it's only temporary. It is because God is trying to teach them something. Such as maybe He was trying to teach Esther in this book. And the last book of the Bible that so many people fear, the book of Revelation, I think is teaching us that very same thing. That God's people will not lose, but there's some things we need to learn along the way. And Zechariah, the second to the last book of the Old Testament, Zechariah chapter 2, the Bible shows that God takes it personally when His people are hurt. It's like poking Him in the eye. Now, you know, when I think about Nathan is, I don't know how tall Nathan is, but he's a lot taller than me, and he's got shoulders this wide, you know, and you know, Nathan looks like he's built pretty good. And he's strong, younger than me, so I know that guy could easily take me. I would never go up to him and say, "Hey, man, can I have something I'd like to say to you?" Poke. Or a police officer pulled me over, and I said, "You know, I'd like to say something to you first." Poke. You know, you're not going to do something like that. Well, listen to Zechariah chapter 2, verse 8. "For thus says the Lord of hosts, He sent me after glory to the nations which plunder you, for he who touches you touches the apple of His eye." Don't mess with God's people. Now, I wondered, why didn't Haman's wife and his friends tell them this before he came up with his plan to get rid of Mordecai? Obviously, they all knew that he was a Jew. And look carefully at the wording of Esther 6:13. Haman spoke of what happened to him rather than of the evil that he's been doing. The man has no sorrow yet for any of his evil. Finally, verse 14. Haman appears to be lifted up momentarily, but it's only to drop him down harder. Verse 14 says, "While they were still talking with him, the king's eunuchs came and hastened to bring Haman the banquet which Esther had prepared." What's he doing? He's going to dine with Mordecai's cousin. And he probably thinks this is a good thing, not knowing it's her, that they're cousins, of course. But I get to go dine with the king and queen. After all the bad things that happened today, this is something good. If Haman thought that he had already been humiliated, boy, was he in for a surprise. If he thought the king, dining with the king and queen, could soothe this humiliation, boy, is he in for a shock of a lifetime. Things are going to get bad. Look at the story of Esther and see what impresses God and what does not impress him. Is he impressed with earthly achievements? Is he impressed with our strutting about how great and wonderful we are? Or is he impressed with humility and the surrendering of ourselves to his will? Again, I point you to Jesus, as we sang a few moments ago, when he was there in the Garden of Gethsemane, just before he dies. Jesus did not want to die. He didn't see it as being a good thing. I mean, he knew the good that would come from it, of course, but he didn't want to go through the suffering of it. And God let him go through it. Although he knew he would only be dead a short while, and that he would be resurrected, giving us hope of eternal life, but still he did not want to go through that experience as short as it was. Let me encourage you this morning to die to yourself as Esther did. You will find your life, bury your old self today, and be resurrected with Christ. When you come up out of that water, you're being resurrected with the one who was resurrected many centuries ago. If you have that need, please come forward now as we stand and sing.